Happy Easter.
This is a perfect Easter movie. We've got a bunny in it, and that's pretty much all you need, right?
That's all there is. And also,
no, there's religion in this movie.
Oh yeah, The Last Temptation of Christ is actually in this movie.
One of the movies. We'll get into it, but there's definitely religion, like Christian religion, in this movie.
And it's like a Christ figure thing.
Yeah, kind of.
Totally. And also, I passed my glucose test, so yeah. I can eat the Easter candy. It's a Halloween movie.
It is also a Halloween movie.
Yeah. I'm Aaron.
I'm Tom.
This is Baby's First Watch List, the podcast doing a new Easter movie that I only considered an Easter movie because of the bunny.
Also, we are definitely, as parents of an almost two-year-old, worn out faces.
It's a mad world.
Yeah. Just before we get started, I just want to remind you guys to follow us everywhere on social media at Baby's First Watch List, because we're going to be posting clips from this episode. We post clips from every episode on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads. No one uses Threads, but we're on there if you're there. Shout out Threads. And we just made a Letterboxd recently, so follow us at BFW Podcast. And also, check us out on Movie Friends Podcast. We were on a podcast last week. We did another Jake Gyllenhaal film.
Roadhouse.
2024's Roadhouse. So, yeah, check us out on that. We're doing some fun things right now.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, but now we're going to get into Donnie Darko.
Yeah, it's the 2001 cult classic, Donnie Darko. So this movie, which honestly is very clearly an October or Halloween movie if you watch it, but I haven't watched it since high school, so I was like, let's do Donnie Darko for Easter.
No, I think it's a fun Easter movie.
Okay. It is a sci-fi thriller written and directed by Richard Kelly, best known for Donnie Darko.
Sure, he's done other stuff, though.
This was his debut. He wrote Domino.
He kind of got, not shunned from Hollywood, but like he didn't enjoy Hollywood,
that vibe,
but he was known for making like kind of crazy movies.
He directed Southland Tales,
which is supposed to be pretty good, actually.
All right, there you go. The music is by Michael Andrews, who did the cover of Mad World with Gary Jules. That's in this movie.
Yes.
Which we'll talk about the music. And he also did the music for a lot of other movies, but I picked out four.
The Mount Rushmore of Michael Andrews movies, counting Donnie Darko.
The Mount Rushmore, which is Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story.
Legendary.
Bridesmaids.
Okay.
Daddy's Home.
Yes.
And Daddy's Home 2.
Wow. We could put Daddy's Home 1 and 2 on the same head on Mount Rushmore.
All right. Yeah,
and then
sure.
The other three, counting Donnie Darko.
Perfect. This movie starred Jake Gyllenhaal, Jenna Malone, Drew Barrymore.
Crazy cast in this movie.
Yeah, you got Mary McDonald, James Duvall, Patrick Swayze's in it, Noah Wiley, the librarian's in it.
Ashley Tisdale's in it.
Very briefly.
I didn't even catch her.
Me either. Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen, memorably.
His debut movie.
Memorably, if not like looking back at it now.
Yes. And the lead singer of Phantom Planet.
Oh, wow.
And do you know who else was in Phantom Planet?
No.
Jason Schwartzman.
Oh.
And he actually
was in the
was
running.
Interested in yeah. being Donnie Darko.
He would have been good.
He would have been good. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Phantom Planet, best known for what?
Jason Schwartzman.
Well, yes, but they did the theme song to what show?
I don't know.
The OC.
Oh, okay.
California, here we come. You know that song?
Yeah.
It's a good one. So Kelly originally conceived the idea for this movie in 1997, and it finally got off the ground with the help from Drew Barrymore's production company. Makes sense.
Yes.
Kelly was inspired by a lot of different things that are very evident in the movie.
Wait, can I just say, not only was it Drew Barrymore, but apparently someone who is very influential in getting this movie made was Christopher Nolan.
Interesting.
It was like right after, I guess.
That makes sense to me.
What did he put out? He put out something in 98. Was it Following? Like he had just had his, like, he wasn't big yet.
Not Insomnia yet?
Insomnia, was that 2002?
I don't know.
It was the early 2000s.
It was a good movie.
It would have been after this movie was made. But he was like kind of on, he was still like way, way early in his career. But I thought that was pretty cool because it makes sense.
It makes total sense, yeah. Actually. So Kelly was inspired by John Hughes movies.
Memento, I think, was 01.
Yeah.
So it was like around that time.
Yep. He also was inspired by Reagan era suburbia.
2000.
Memento. Urban Legends and A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking.
Yes.
All of that tracks.
Yep.
Filmed
A Brief History of Time's in the movie.
Yes. Filmed over a month in California in the year 2000. It premiered at Sundance in early 2001. It then had a quite a quiet release in October 2001. That was mostly due to, of course, we always happen to mention 9/11, the 9/11 attacks.
Listen, 9/11 is a formative moment in U.S. history in our childhood. We were like 9 years old, so
yes,
of course we're gonna, and we live in New Jersey, of course we're gonna talk about 9/11.
Very true. But in the, a big part of the marketing for this movie was a plane crash, and so obviously it was not marketed very much. And so because of that, it only made a little over $500,000 in its initial run. But its profits did grow to $7.5 million, recouping its $4.5 million budget and becoming a cult classic.
Kind of like word of mouth, because I remember when I was...
Oh, yeah.
Not when I was nine, because I wasn't like watching movies like this yet, but I remember like when I was a teenager, people would be like, oh my God, have you seen Donnie Darko? Donnie Darko. Like,
I watched it in high school.
My brother had the DVD. I remember the bunny thing on the DVD. It always creeped me out.
It's kind of funny though, because although I remember it being this big... filmy movie when I was in high school, watching it now, it doesn't feel that way as much.
No, I mean, it feels like a cult classic.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. But it's not this, I don't know. I feel like when I first watched it, it was this like, oh my God movie.
Well, cause it has a crazy sort of incomprehensible ending. It was one of those movies. It was a big time for those types of movies.
Sure. You're right. So, this
and
is
it was
of,
dark, and people liked dark movies like this back then.
That is very, very true.
I didn't find the movie to be extremely dark this time in its themes.
No.
But you, there's a reading
there's,
of it,
there's
for sure.
Some,
it's heavy, but it's not necessarily
some heavy
dark.
Stuff. This is really cool. The website to Donnie Darko, which you can actually still find in the Wayback Machine, and the Wikipedia page has the link for it. It was a cool digital marketing tool. It had puzzles and behind-the-scenes info about the world of Donnie Darko, including the later fates of all the characters.
Mm.
So after you watch the movie, you could go to the website, and you could... It's kind of like AmandaPlease.com.
Exactly. AmandaPlease.
So I really think it would be interesting to go and kind of look through that website in the Wayback Machine now. It used to be DonnieDarko.com. It's not anymore. And I just like that idea of, I think Richard Kelly said something, instead of being an outsider to the movie, you can kind of feel yourself kind of in it a little bit more.
So the book that Grandma Death wrote in this movie, he actually wrote part of that book for that same reason, because he wanted it to be sort of fleshed out and not just a prop in the movie. He wanted it to be like a real thing.
You could very much tell that this is a passion project for the writer-director. A terrible sequel that he was not involved in, about Donnie's younger sister called S. Darko, was released in 2009.
The least interesting of the siblings, in my opinion.
It was absolutely panned and made no noise at all. And but the original Empire magazine, are they a magazine?
Sure.
They ranked the original as number 2 on their 50 greatest independent films of all time list.
Wow.
Do you know what number 1 is?
Blair Witch Project.
Oh, that's a great guess. No.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
That's also an
Pulp
excellent
Fiction?
Guess. You're very close.
Reservoir Dogs?
Yes, it's Reservoir Dogs.
I got there.
Donnie Darko was actually ranked number 2. I actually want to go through that list. Not today, necessarily, but...
Starting right now.
but I didn't go super into the background with Donnie Darko, but if you want to start talking about your notes... And...
Yeah, we'll jump right into the movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of a really cool opening. I like the opening. It was like Gyllenhaal is like, he wakes up in like the middle of the street, and his bike is like nearby, and then he bikes home, and it's I thought it was NXS, but I think I was like subconsciously mixing it up with the director's cut, because I think I had read about the director's cut.
Oh, okay.
It was not an NXS song. It was a song called "The Killing Moon" by Echo and the Bunnymen, which is funny, Bunnymen.
Yes.
And he's like biking home in pajamas and slippers and all that. And it's like a really, it's a striking opening.
It is.
In this movie. And it really sets you, with the tone of the song and the sort of like, he just like sort of gets up and gets on the bike. It's sort of an expected thing. There's nothing, he's not scared, he's not whatever.
It drops you right in.
It drops you right in, and it drops you into a universe where you're like, there's something up here. Like instantly. Mm-hmm. And you don't know what it is. I also wrote the pizza in the first family scene. Like, he goes home, and then that night they're eating dinner together, and it's the parents, and it's Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Donnie. It's Elizabeth, who is Maggie Gyllenhaal's older sister. Mm-hmm. And then Samantha is DeVay Chase, who you might know from The Ring and from Lilo and Stitch. Mm-hmm. And also, she played in the dub of Spirited Away. She was the lead girl. Kind of a weird, crazy
career.
Couple of years for her. Mm-hmm. This included.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really fun seeing Maggie and Jake kind of argue with each other.
Yeah, that was cool. That was very cool.
I read that Kelly basically was like, he didn't plan on casting her, but somebody recommended her to him, and then he just kind of saw them interacting, and he was like, this will work.
She's a good actress.
She is. I think that she is a little underrated.
I know that she is a movie secretary that's supposed to be really interesting.
I feel like people didn't love her in The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And then that kind of...
I mean, she was better than Katie Holmes.
Yeah. I mean, what's the bar here? I also didn't realize there's this. A lot of this goes on early in the movie. I didn't realize when I first watched this, which was in like college or something, like back in my Denzel Nolan days. A lot of George H.W. Bush versus Michael Dukakis talk in this movie.
George H.W. Oh, because they were.
It's the end of the Reagan era.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it's like in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then they showed a debate, and one of the debates was Bush against Dukakis.
Yep.
I didn't recognize when I was younger how much this movie had to do with like
Reagan era politics,
the decline during the Reagan era.
It's really interesting. Yeah. The point of view with that is fascinating. And now when we watch movies from that time period or that's set in that time period, it is really interesting to see how different directors and writers and filmmakers viewed that time period.
It's a strange, like, it's almost like how you've talked about with Uncut Gems, where it's like the recent history,
mm-hmm.
the recent history period pieces.
Yeah, and I find it so cool.
For 2001, this was a recent history period piece. Yeah. It was 13 or so years prior. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be super, super interesting. And it sort of sets up one of the big themes of the movie, which is the generational gap.
Mm-hmm.
You have the parents, or at least the dad, who is very pro George Bush, Reagan, clearly, and is like cursing at Dukakis during the debate, mm-hmm. under his breath. And the especially Elizabeth, the oldest sister,
Maggie Gyllenhaal,
who is like very pro Dukakis. She says, I'm going to vote Dukakis. And then they have like a political debate at dinner over this. And of course, Dukakis was one of the more, I would say, ineffectual candidates.
He like, got wiped out.
Like he got waxed by George H.W. because, you know, most of the country at the time loved Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
So that Bush was his vice president, and that kind of carried over into that election.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a really fun sort of flashpoint, interesting flashpoint.
It is interesting
for them to focus on. So then we get Donnie starting to sleepwalk, and he's seeing this bunny who's saying things like 28 days. I forget what the exact phrase was. It's like 28 days, 12 hours. Donnie Darko, 28
It even
days.
Goes to minutes and seconds.
28 days, 6 hours, 42 minutes, and 12 seconds. The world will end.
How many people do you think have that tattooed on their arm?
Oh, literally, when you look up Donnie Darko, 28 days, first thing that comes up is quote, second thing that comes up is tattoo.
Totally.
So,
I'd be scared if I got that on my arm. I don't think I'd like that.
And I just wrote, this sleepwalking seems a lot less fun than in Step Brothers.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so he says that, and then there's an earthquake jump scare, which eventually turns out to be a plane engine crashing through the roof of the Darko household.
Into Donnie's room.
Into Donnie's room, but he's not there because he's out sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote that it's a narrative choice in this movie to have an event happen, and then they go back and explain it later.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the engine crashing through the house, and then you don't really know what it is. And then a couple of minutes later, you know, Gyllenhaal gets home. And he sees everyone outside, and they're like, oh my God, a plane engine went through the house.
Yeah, it's cool.
So, like, you get the initial, it's almost like the beginning, too, where, like, he wakes up, and then he drives home, he bikes home, and, like, you don't know anything about that until the sleepwalking kind of explains it, mm-hmm. later on, which I think is a cool thing to do. It makes the audience kind of think, and then it does explain to some degree what's going on, even if it doesn't give you spell it out for you a lot of the time.
Maybe it's sort of, like, practice for us as the audience. That we're not going to get answers.
It's priming
either
you.
Right away or at all. And these are kind of mini ones where it's like, yeah, that's confusing. But look, we're explaining a couple minutes later. And then they can kind of make those confusing parts more confusing later.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting way to build tension. And it's also a way to kind of put you in Donnie's shoes of it kind of being almost dreamlike, where like anything can happen at any time.
It's also something that's very connectable to real life. A lot of times we have things happen and we don't get answers or explanations for them until later on.
Yeah. Not a lot about this movie is like real life, I would say, but
maybe that's, more than you think.
Yeah, maybe. So he goes to school and it's a private school and it's like, everybody's just awful. Like, it's all these like stuck up kids.
They're really mean to, and they bully people.
Most of the teachers are kind of like insufferable.
But they're very smart.
The parents are insufferable. I just wrote public schools forever. Sorry about it.
We are always going to be pro public school. But I did read that they didn't have the budget to have everyone wear 80s style costumes. So they made it a private school so that they could all wear the same uniform. And it also was a good narrative wise for Donnie to be able to kind of rebel against that system.
And it also sort of ties it in and warps the typical John Hughes type high school movie mm-hmm. into something a little bit more stuck up and sinister than a lot of his movies are.
Yep.
So there's a plot point in this movie about the story by Graham Greene called The Destructors. I meant to read it before.
Is it a real story?
I think it is.
I should know that.
So they have a lesson on it, and Drew Barrymore is his like new. Is she new?
She seems new.
She seems new.
She's doing stuff that she's not acclimated should not be to happening.
This, yeah. She's the English teacher, and she's
like trying to set up the kids, and so it's like, oh, right. Girl, you must be new.
Right. Or it's the 80s. So it's a story about how these kids kind of they break into this old man's house, and they end up like stealing his money. But they don't use the money, they just burn it. And it's kind of emblematic of the whole movie. Because Donnie talks about how, like, they don't care about the money. They just want to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, it ties in with the another one of the big themes of this movie, which is fate versus free will.
Mm-hmm.
And in that story, free will, you would think, wins out because fate... You would think that the predetermined outcome would be the kids steal the money and they go whatever, but they're sort of rebelling against that idea of time and fate and all that. Then he kind of talks to Jenna Malone, who he meets after he floods the school.
Gretchen,
about how he wants to be a writer and stuff, so he can change things. So he's clearly getting kind of like influence from that book.
Short story though, right?
It's a short story, yeah. There, so then we see kind of an old lady in the street who they almost hit.
Yeah, that should be my Halloween costume.
Grandma Death.
Yeah.
And she just keeps walking back and forth to her mailbox, and we sort of circle back around to that later.
Again, another thing that's confusing at first, like kind of mysterious.
Yeah.
Then we find out later.
And we get Donnie's going to therapy, and then there's the meme line where he's like, oh, I made another friend. I made a friend today, and the therapist is like, real or imaginary? And Gyllenhaal looks at the camera and he just goes, imaginary.
The movie's funny.
It is funny. There's a lot of little lines.
It's funnier than I remembered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the school gets flooded. There's a thing that says they made me do it on the outside, and there's an axe, right? Is that at this point? Where's the axe mm-hmm. through the head of the mascot?
Yeah.
It's a really kind of creepy scene.
It is creepy. The mascot itself is creepy too.
Yeah.
It looks like Winton from Bluey in the episode we watched where it's the dream.
Yeah. They're
like jacked.
Their mascot is the Mongrels.
Yeah.
Seth Rogen has his first line in film, and it's telling Jenna Malone that he likes her boobs.
So Seth Rogen.
Yeah. He's one of the bullies. He's not a funny character.
No, although he has literally two lines in three lines, and he says them with
like, the Seth Rogen cadence.
Yeah,
and everything.
So I guess you kind of think that they're kind of funny, but they're not.
Yeah, and then his buddy was like holding a knife to Donnie's throat in the bathroom because he thought that Donnie set him up to be the one that flooded
mm-hmm.
the school, or was telling people that he flooded the school. And I was like, yeah, that's so 80s.
Yeah.
We get a PTA meeting where the iconic parent, Mrs. Farmer.
She's also a teacher.
Who's also a teacher, is trying to get The Destructors banned. The book, The Destructors, or short story, The Destructors, banned. The reason I keep saying book is because she's holding up a book that says The Destructors on it, but I think it is a short story. And because in that book, they break the water main and flood something in the book.
So she, of course, is blaming the
yes.
the text
yes.
for the behavior.
Donnie later challenges her in her class because she sets up this thing called the fear to love continuum. And she's like, everything you experience, every emotion falls on some continuum of fear to love. And Donnie sort of challenges her on that. Because again, we are taking our younger generation is challenging our older generation's preconceived notions about emotions, which are, you know, most people would say, I think, that their parents' emotions are more stifled than theirs are. Especially going back to thinking about people who are from like the 50s, you know, grew up in the 50s and 60s as compared to people who grew up in the 80s and 90s and later. There's a lot of like this also fits in with the political crossroads, right, with Dukakis and Bush. And also to me, the dramatic irony of knowing who won.
Yes.
So he then starts to develop an interest in time travel. And he talks to like the science teacher or whatever.
Yeah, Noah Wiley.
Who's like a professor. Like he's like the super, super smart guy.
Yeah, I'm like, wow.
Not professor, like a PhD.
Yeah.
He's like a super, super smart guy. He talks about a brief history of time. And he shows him this book. And the book is called Philosophy of Time Travel. And it's by
Roberta Sparrow.
Roberta Sparrow. I was trying to think of her last name.
Great name.
Roberta Sparrow. Who he figures out is Grandma Death, the lady who keeps going back and forth to the mailbox.
And she used to work at the school.
So he goes home, and he's now that he's sort of been exposed to all these ideas, he's sort of seeing this like blob coming out of people and like leading them toward what they're doing next.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting there, like it's a physical manifestation of time, obviously. Time and like its linearity and fate and everything like that, as if we're all just being drawn along by this blob. But it's funny because I read that Richard Kelly came up with this while he was watching football, and he saw what like John Madden would do, like the telestrator, where he would draw on the screen and like show you where the players were going on the instant replay. And he said he watched it and he started to think about what would happen if like a god or some type of like, so I think he said someone upstairs did that like in real life. And he was like, that's how I came up with
cool.
That sort of concept. And it's funny because it happens for the first time when they're watching football.
Ah.
Then we get Patrick Swayze as Jim Cunningham, the motivational speaker.
Mm-hmm.
They bring him in to kind of pump up the kids and like
talk about fear
and, yeah, and getting in touch with your emotions and like, mm-hmm, being, you know, overcoming all this stuff. And it's very clearly sort of like a charlatan like type character,
like a Tony Robbins kind of.
Yeah, but like even more ridiculous in my opinion. So he comes and he does a presentation at the school, and Donnie again gets up and he makes a statement. He says, "I think you're the effing Antichrist," to Jim Cunningham.
Yeah, Donnie Darko, he is not exactly the most affable, likable character.
Yeah,
where he's not friendly. He's definitely very confrontational, even to his parents and to, yeah, his sister. Like he fights with everybody.
Yeah, so he's dating Gretchen's character, and they go to the movies, and they're seeing there's a double bill for Halloween. It's The Evil Dead and The Last Temptation of Christ, which is kind of a crazy double bill. So he's sitting, and then you get the iconic scene where he's watching the movie with her, and she's asleep. And then he turns to the left, and then Frank is sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Frank shows him his eye, which is bleeding,
mm-hmm,
which is why he wears the mask.
Mm-hmm.
Frank then has him go burn Patrick Swayze, Jim Cunningham's house, to the ground, which was wild. And then we find out that Jim Cunningham had some stuff in his house on his computers.
Not so good.
That were not good.
Mm-mm.
Cunningham goes down. This is kind of where like the climax starts. We're like, there's a Halloween party at their house. The mom and the sister are at the Sparkle Motion dance,
yes,
thing.
Star Search,
yeah. Donnie and Gretchen kind of hook up or whatever. And then he realizes that there's only a few hours left until the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes to Grandma Death's house to sort of, I guess, talk with her or meet with her. And he finds that Seth Rogen and the other guy, whose name I forget, the other bully who held the knife to him earlier, are in the basement, and we're just burglarizing the house. Unfortunately, they get into a scuffle, and Gretchen gets run over by a car. And who steps out of the car but a kid in a clown costume and a kid in a bunny costume, whose name is Frank, who is actually Elizabeth's boyfriend.
And we saw him earlier at the movie theater.
He was also in the first scene when Donnie wakes up. You see him driving by in his Trans Am. So Gretchen dies. Frank gets shot by Donnie in the eye.
In the eye.
And it's interesting because you see you see it from Donnie's point of view, and you see the blob like going towards his eye. It's like kind of distorted, which is I thought was a really cool way to use that effect. So Donnie brings Gretchen, in his car, and he's like looking out over his house when there's a vortex forming, and the plane carrying his mom and sister. It is inferred, I think,
yes,
that it flies into this vortex and the engine falls out of it. And so we get like a rewind of the whole movie. And the plane engine crashes into the room with Donnie inside of it.
Yeah.
Then we get Mad World, which is a great ending to the movie.
And before it crashes, Donnie's laughing.
Yes. He figured it out. He figured out time travel. He figured out how to make everything better in his view, which we'll get into. We start back on October 2nd, I think it was. And, they're wheeling out Donnie's body. And you sort of get a montage of everybody. You see Frank is, like shaken up in his room. And he's crying out of the same eye that he is now fine. You get Cunningham, who is like freaked out, and he ends up killing himself on the golf course on the same hole that he saw Donnie at in the beginning of the movie. And then we see Gretchen alive again, biking towards the house. And then she like asks a neighbor, like, what's going on here? He tells her, and then she looks at Donnie's mom and waves to her. And then she's like, basically like, why did I do that? And the mom waved back.
Mm-hmm. They kind of knew each other, but didn't know how.
Yeah. And then that's the end of Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
Crazy movie.
Yeah.
What did you think about this movie?
Yeah, my first question was like, is this a good movie? I will say, I did not remember it. When I watched it in high school, it was a completely different movie than I had remembered.
I remembered parts of it, but I didn't get as much out of it as I did this time.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's a good movie. I liked it a lot, actually.
It's a good movie. It's a challenging movie. And
it keeps your attention.
Yeah.
What I like about it is it is, of course, very challenging in that there's a lot of ideas and theories and maybe rights and wrongs and analyzing you could do. But you could also just watch it to enjoy it as it is. And even if you don't get it, which... Does anybody get it? I don't know.
Seth Rogen and Jake Gyllenhaal at the rap party, so they had no idea what the movie was about.
Yeah, even if you don't get it, you still can... I still found it like a fun watch.
Oh, yeah.
Where a lot was happening. You kept wondering what was going to happen. It is a thriller. It's funny. It's a period piece. I really enjoyed it.
It's very unique.
I also found the performances overall to be really good.
Yeah, there were a couple that were iffy.
But Jake Gyllenhaal was really good.
Gyllenhaal and Swayze and the mom. I forget the actress.
Mary McDonald.
McDonald. Those were the three standouts to me.
The therapist was good, too.
Yeah, she was good.
I think it is a good movie.
I agree. I definitely think it's a good movie. Is it one of my favorites? Probably not. But
no.
I especially if you're a fan of Gyllenhaal or you're a fan of Swayze, like it's a fun one, I think, in their filmographies.
Definitely. Yeah.
Drew Barrymore, I'm glad that she's in this because the movie wouldn't have been made without her.
And she plays against type, which is cool.
She does play against type. I just wish there was more of that character. I didn't care when she got fired, really. Like, I get the point of it and all that, but there wasn't enough for me there to connect with the character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought that Jenna Malone's character was just kind of, like, there to be a love interest. I didn't find her to be vital to the movie.
Well, I think that she had such a tragic background.
Yeah, she did.
That I think that's part of it where it's, like, you can kind of go in all different directions with your trauma or your... problems and whatever, and so she goes in sort of a different direction than Donnie does,
yeah,
even though they end up together.
That's another one of Seth Rogen's three lines. He said, didn't your dad like stab your mom?
Yeah.
In the Seth Rogen voice.
Oh.
Oh, man.
So what's your favorite and least favorite thing about this movie?
My favorite? I just think this movie makes audacious choices.
Yeah.
It challenges the audience and it makes the audience, it's like, hang in there. Like, just come for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't give you a lot. And the stuff that it does give you are only, as we kind of talked about, sort of the building blocks.
Mm-hmm.
I also loved the strangeness of the screenplay.
Yeah.
Like the line when they're in the movie theater and Donnie's like to Frank, he says, "Why are you wearing that stupid bunny suit?" And Frank goes, "Why are you wearing that stupid man suit?"
That I feel like is such a line that a freshman in college is like, wow.
It is. But it's so like, why? Like it's such a creative thing, mm-hmm. because like there's no other movie with lines.
It's a unique
like that.
Screenplay for sure.
And of course, when Mrs. Farmer is at with Donnie's mom, and she's like, "You have to go to the Star Search because I can't go because and all the other and
yeah,
all
but
the other,
only reason she can't go is because she's there to be like
she's supporting Cunningham.
Cunningham after he was arrested for awful crime,
basically saying it was a witch hunt.
Yes,
about Cunningham.
Which it's like, wow, that movie came out in 2001, and nowadays. You could see that happening
so much,
easily.
So much about Mrs. Farmer and the adults in this movie is still applicable today.
Very much so. The PTA meetings, the whole thing.
Yeah, what's that quote that she says? I have it. It's
like,
it's.
Sometimes I feel like you don't even care about sparkle motion or whatever.
Sometimes I doubt your commitment to sparkle motion.
It's so good. It's a really funny movie.
It is. Yeah, so I mean that's what I really like about this movie. What I didn't like is it still does kind of feel like edgy for the sake of being edgy.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I didn't really, like I said, I didn't really love the romance storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the movie's pretty good.
It is pretty good.
I don't have much bad to say about it.
Something else I really liked about the movie, I feel like the late 80s-ness of it really does hit. The soundtrack is on point.
Unreal soundtrack in this movie.
It is very much on point.
Not only with the content, like the songs, but the timing also.
Yeah. Well, even, it's so funny, like, even the, you could just tell that this guy that made this movie was so in. Like, everything was thought out. Like, in Mad World, there's the line, you know, "The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had."
Yeah.
Which, like, it's just the timing. It's just
well,
so...
And in the NXS song that wasn't in the theatrical cut, there's a thing about worlds colliding, too.
Yeah. Like, you could tell that this was just such a passion project, and I really liked that. As far as things I didn't like, I do feel like the portrayal of mental illness is dated.
Not ideal.
I struggle with that a little bit. But again, I know that could be a choice, artistic choice, when it comes to having a hero that is flawed and, troubled.
Well, we have to keep in mind, too, that this movie is sci-fi and it's fantasy. Like, there was the one line where... when he tells, I think it was when he tells Gretchen his name, she's like, "Oh, what are you, a superhero?" Because he has like a alliterative name, like a lot of Peter Parker, Bruce Banner, like all those names, you know?
Well, and I kind of like the fact that this guy kind of is a superhero at the end. And just He saves the world at the end. That's good stuff right there. And just like they go to see Evil Dead and the other... thing on the bill is The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
And you kind of have that sacrificial thing at the end
that
with him.
That I read, like, confirmed was 100% intentional.
Yeah? Okay, yeah. Good. Because I caught that, where I was like, oh, so it's kind of like a Christ figure sort of thing?
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of interesting, especially when during this time period, religion was considered very much a hallmark of suburbia and very, very important. But this character who maybe shows some of those traits or whatever is very much not appreciated in that moment
by the Mrs. Farmers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
His dad, even not that he didn't have a bad relationship with his dad.
No,
it wasn't
very,
it wasn't one of those like stereotypically,
not at all. It's just distant, which I think is kind of accurate to how a lot of people's relationships are. And something else that I thought was interesting is, you know, it's the end of the Reagan era, and Nancy Reagan's thing was just say no with drugs, right?
Yep.
And Donnie's parents are very pro-Reagan, right? Mm-hmm. But they also were very pro-upping his medication.
Right.
And so it's kind of interesting.
It's because they don't want to actually confront the problem. They want to throw something at it.
Yeah. And I thought that that was probably done on purpose,
too. 100%.
Yeah. So I like all of that kind of stuff connected together. I think it's a lot of ideas.
I kind of love how much of a mess this movie is.
Yeah, and I don't mind that. You know, I would rather have something with a lot of ideas and a lot of interpretations than none.
Well, and he even said that about the director's cut, because a lot of times when you think director's cut, you think like, oh, this is what the director wanted me to see. This one is not really that. This one was an alternate cut, and it sort of, from what I understand, I have not seen it, it explains more. And people don't like it because it kind of handholds you, whereas the theatrical cut doesn't. And Richard Kelly said, either one is good.
He's happy with
he loves the he likes the theatrical one, but for the reason that it doesn't give you as much. Mm-hmm. He likes that having the movie having like an air of mystery to it.
Yeah, that's cool. Another thing, I really enjoyed Jake Gyllenhaal in this. I thought that, for being kind of in the early parts of his career, it was a really cool movie to do.
Yeah.
It just kind of was this little peek into sort of what he could do his later
Prisoners,
on.
Nightcrawler.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, he did Bubble Boy around the same time. But then he tried to go a little more mainstream with Day After Tomorrow.
Brokeback Mountain.
And then you got into more artsy stuff the next year with Brokeback Mountain. So I'm wondering.
And he's sort of jumped back and forth.
Oh, yeah. He's done all kinds of interesting made all kinds of interesting choices. So I'm wondering what your favorite, maybe least favorite, Jake Gyllenhaal movie or performance has been.
My favorite.
That you've seen. We haven't seen all of his movies, but we've seen a lot.
Yeah, I've probably seen 10 or more. My favorite is probably Prisoners.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
That movie is awesome. And it also has one of my favorite. He's also Detective Loki in that movie, which I find to be such a like a movie name.
Yeah.
I think it's probably Prisoners. I'm looking at his list right now. I did love him in Zodiac.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Zodiac's such a good movie.
Yeah. So I would probably go with Prisoners. I actually thought he was underrated. He does not get his flowers for Spider-Man Far From Home.
Oh, yeah. I didn't watch that, but people do say that he's really good in that.
He played Mysterio. Who's like an actor who's like the villain.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool.
It's fun.
It's a really cool role for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot of good ones.
I really loved Brokeback Mountain.
Brokeback Mountain too. Yeah, of course.
You know, it was.
Remember
big,
when he was Prince of Persia?
I was gonna say Prince of Persia as a joke.
Yikes.
yeah, Brokeback Mountain. I think it was a really awesome that he took that role in 2005. Him and Heath Ledger. I do think Heath Ledger was probably the performance I preferred out of the two, but I thought they were both really excellent in it.
And I don't think either of them would do it now because of what, you know, the representation and all that stuff. Maybe they would, but I feel like the movie would be cast differently now. But since it came out in 2005, I think that he and Heath Ledger were like, you can't beat that casting.
And it was, I think, great that they took on those roles, especially because they got a lot of criticism for it.
Yeah.
Not in a way that they would be criticized now.
No, in a homophobic way.
Exactly. Yeah. And that movie's just beautiful.
It's a really lovely
movie.
I like Ang Lee a lot.
He's great. And then I thought his performance in Nightcrawler was really cool.
It's creepy. Riz Ahmed in that movie is great too.
He's great. and that movie is very stylistic. It's kind of Drive-esque, kind of A24-esque, before those movies became super popular.
Yeah.
And it showed Gyllenhaal in a more kind of manic way, which I had never seen up until that point.
You get it a little bit in Zodiac.
A little bit. He's a little unhinged.
Towards this third act kind of thing. When he's in the basement, like in that scene.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a good scene.
Yeah.
And then nothing happens. Oh, yeah. It's so good. So, yeah, I really like all of those. I like when he picks roles that are a little bit off kilter, less traditional leading man.
What do you think he's known the most for? This was one of my questions.
That's a really good question.
Because what made me think of this was reading the Roger Ebert review of Donnie Darko, where he referred to him as, and what else would he have been? Like, he wasn't in that much before this. He called him Jake Gyllenhaal from October Sky.
Yeah. I mean.
And I was like, what is Jake Gyllenhaal? Probably
Donnie Darko.
Donnie Darko and Brokeback Mountain. Brokeback Mountain. I think, probably. And yeah. Bubble Boy.
No, not seriously. Now.
Well, I mean, from the time. Like.
Has he ever been nominated for an Oscar?
I don't think so.
Was he up for Brokeback Mountain?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I would say probably Donnie Darko and Brokeback Mountain.
He was
nominated. Okay.
His only nomination, Brokeback Mountain. Okay. Best Supporting Actor.
But he's such a well-known actor, so that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I would say probably this and Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, and sort of piggybacking off of that, as I mentioned, we just did an episode with our movie friends podcast on Roadhouse 2024, which came out a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. How do you think Gyllenhaal has sort of progressed in his career from a movie like Donnie Darko, which is not his first movie, but the earliest that we've seen 23 years ago, to Roadhouse?
I think that he's definitely more confident in sort of emphasizing the comedy in his roles.
Yeah.
I think he says lines really funny in Donnie Darko. He does a good job. You can see it's there. But he was a kid.
I think this whole movie is raw Gyllenhaal. Like, you see everything that he can do now.
Exactly.
You see Prisoners. You see, even like, I didn't really like this movie, but you see Nocturnal Animals. Like, you see
so much
of where he would go.
Yeah.
You even see in the scenes with Jenna Malone a little bit of the Brokeback Mountain, where he's able to sort of like let someone into his hardened exterior. Mm-hmm. And I just think that you see the little bits and pieces of it. I think it's really interesting that we watched Roadhouse and then watched this like right afterwards.
Yeah.
Almost in reverse order. Mm-hmm. Because it's almost like there's a sketch of 2024 Jake Gyllenhaal on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you can totally see, you could pull everything that he's done since then from Donnie Darko. I think that this is a role that sort of encompasses it all.
Yeah.
Even the dumb stuff in Roadhouse.
Yeah. Roadhouse was great.
It was. It was fun.
My last question here. So this movie is confusing.
It is.
What are some other confusing movies that you can think about? I mean, I'm going to tell you right now, the number one that everyone says is Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
And that is a very confusing movie.
It is confusing.
I think I got the bare bones pretty good.
We were watching it, and you, I think, hit the nail on the head on that one.
Yeah.
Which was, it was basically about a actress who goes to Hollywood, and it's not really what she thinks it was going to be. And then she sort of, I don't know, maybe hallucinates some sort of psychosis, and there's this whole separate storyline that is what she thinks it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And how everything kind of gets turned upside down.
Yeah.
If you look at it through that lens, I thought the movie kind of did make sense.
Yeah. That's what I got from it, from my first viewing, just as I was watching. But even then, it's still so much.
It's opaque.
Yeah. It's not my thing. I know a lot of people truly, truly love that movie.
It hits with me in hindsight. I didn't love it when I watched it, but I find myself thinking about it a lot.
There's some things that I struggle with that movie with like the male gaziness of it all.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. That's for sure. And that's my thing with these types of movies. I find them interesting, but they're never going to be my favorites. Inception was one that is also considered a very confusing movie.
Don't find it to be.
I find it to be confusing, the whole dream, not dream, blah, blah, blah thing. I know a lot of people talk about the ending. I don't find the ending to be particularly confusing. But
what you take from the dream within a dream within a dream, once you realize that the music is slowed down the further into a dream you are, you can kind of figure it out from there. It's the same track for most of the movie, but it's slowed down more the deeper you are into the dream.
And then for me, another confusing thing is any spy movie, any movie that has like procedural stuff in it.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was the one.
No idea.
Specifically that came to mind for me that I just didn't get. It didn't click with me. Didn't understand it.
Anything that's like you're on this mission and here's the parliament and this. And that, I'm always just like, no idea.
If you throw parliament into something, Aaron, I have no idea. Out.
Unless it's the traitor season 2, I'm out.
The one guy from Parliament that was in it.
That's right. But like anything like that where you're trying to get me to figure out who, because here's the thing, it's always 45-year-old white guys that like all look the same.
All look the same.
They all somehow look like Mark Strong. Every single character in all those movies. And I'm just like...
And Mark Strong's in all of them?
He's in all of them. And you're just like, well, that's Mark Strong 3. I don't know what Mark Strong 3 is doing. So anything spy-like, anything that's like that,
yes,
that's a no.
I've got two for you. I'm thinking of Ending Things.
Oh, yeah. Charlie Kaufman. See that. Any Charlie Kaufman thing is going to be confusing.
It's very surreal. And the story kind of contradicts itself. And there's a lot of strange things going on that are sort of unexplained. And it's mainly about the relationship between the Jesse Plemons character and the Jesse Buckley character. Mm-hmm. And like one scene, the parents who are, I think, David Thewlis and Toni Collette are like normal age. And then the next, they're old. And then you see them again and they're young again. And it's like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
One that I haven't seen is Tenet, which I feel like just has to get thrown out
there. No one understands Tenet from what I understand.
And then a movie called Coherence.
Don't know.
It's a very small sci-fi movie. There's eight people and they're at like a dinner party when a comet is supposed to pass Earth. And then there's a bunch of like strange things going on and they end up kind of like meeting alternate versions of themselves. And like somebody will go out and then they'll come back and it'll be somebody from a different dinner party who went out to see what was going on at that dinner party. And then, but it's the same group of friends.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like all the same actors, all the same people, but they're playing like four different characters.
That's crazy.
It was a cool movie, but I want to jump into now sort of what I think the generally accepted explanation for Donnie Darko is.
Okay.
So there's a website, donniedarko.org.uk.
Nice.
That explains it for everybody. So if you've wondered what happened in Donnie Darko, here's what I guess it's the first thing that comes up on Google. What happened in Donnie Darko? So we're watching the parallel universe.
Oh, no.
We're not watching the main universe.
We're starting in with parallel universes.
Well, that's philosophy of time travel. That's the whole thing.
That's another thing. I don't like time travel. I'm over time travel.
I think that you need, if you want to understand it, it's there. Mm-hmm. If you pay attention to it.
Okay.
So we don't know what causes this break in the universes, but it has something to do with the engine falling, because it's the engine and there's no plane crash.
No.
It's just an engine. So there's been nothing reported about a plane missing an engine or anything like that. It's just like a spare engine. So Donnie is, as we've talked about, sort of the Christ-like figure, the chosen one. He, you know, is kind of blessed with almost like supernatural powers at certain points of this movie. He is able to break the water main with an axe. He's kind of, you know... There's parts where he's like using telekinesis and like you can kind of see it physically manifest. He doesn't know that he's a part of this tangent universe, but he's supposed to like... The whole point of this parallel universe is to fix the main universe. Whatever happened in the main universe needs to be fixed. So there's things called the manipulated dead and the manipulated living. The manipulated dead are Frank and Gretchen. They're killed in our tangent universe.
Mm-hmm.
And they travel back in time to help him sort of make things go how they were supposed to go, which is him getting crushed by the engine.
Do they know that?
Gretchen and Frank?
Yeah.
I would guess that Frank does, but Gretchen doesn't.
Well, because Frank's got that tear at the end.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's the whole thing. It's like when all of this gets rewound, all of these people still have a connection to the parallel universe because... Cunningham does what he does. Frank's crying. Gretchen kind of acknowledges.
Waves and is like, what?
Yeah. Then there's also the manipulated living who are there to sort of guide Donnie, who is referred to as the living receiver. This is all in the book that Richard Kelly wrote.
Oh, okay.
So
that tracks that.
Or extrapolated from it. So the manipulated living is kind of... It's all the other people but who's the manipulator? And people think it's God or it's some sort of like other force in this movie that we never really meet. Gretchen is really important to this because she is sort of the catalyst for him, like, she's the one that puts him over the top to realize what he has to do, and that he needs to be in the room when this thing drops. Donnie was saved from death, and he is now in, like, a situation where he's a killer on the run. You know, he's got like, everything. He's lost everything at this point at the end of the movie. He knows that sending the engine of the train, the plane that his parent, that his mom and his sister are on, will erase the last 28 days from history, and time will go back to October 2nd when Gretchen is still alive. So at the end of the movie, he kind of, the theory is that he uses that telekinesis that he's been using to tear the engine from the plane when it hits the vortex, and guides it back into our universe, or, you know, the movie canon universe. He is no longer afraid to die, as we see, when time rolls back. He's laughing. He knows it worked. He knows everybody's going to be okay. And he's sacrificing himself for the good of everybody else. And people probably are having dreams or something, some sort of, like, psychic connection to this parallel universe. And the thing that happens at the end in the montage, I think, is proof of that. So essentially, the movie is, our whole thing is the rescue mission for everything that's going on in the other universe, which is the stuff that we see at the end. Whether that's right or not, I mean, it seems to track with what Kelly has written and sort of hinted at. Is that really what happens? Who knows? But I think that's, like, the leading theory. Now, the question is, why? Like, what is the movie trying to say? I think we got into it a little bit. With sort of the generational gap and sort of the ability of people in the younger generation to, let's say, sacrifice themselves or to sort of go out on a limb and be more expressive with their either emotions or their ideas, or sort of trying to wriggle out from the repressiveness of those sort of Nancy Reagan, Ronald Reagan policies, which you get a little bit from Elizabeth, but obviously you get a lot more from Donnie because more screen time, more craziness. What else do you think?
Yeah, I think that also there's this pull towards, like, accepting people that are different. So, like, Donnie has a lot going on, right? And instead of just, he, from the beginning, his whole thing is, like, he doesn't want to numb these feelings and numb these things that are going on. And that's what is causing that anger towards his parents at the beginning. And that he, if you look under all of the kind of obvious things that need attention about him, his mental illness, things like that, there is someone who really does want the good of himself out there and really, really wants human connection.
He's very afraid to die alone.
Yes, that's a whole thing. And I think it's the same sort of idea when we're having sympathy for that the classmate, the girl that's in the talent show that's bullied the whole time, right? That is secretly in love with Donnie, you know, and he's the only one that's, like, even kind of nice to her. And it's this idea of this want for human connection. And I think that that's something that's, like, throughout the entire movie. And doing it in a way that is hopefully a little bit more positive. It doesn't need to be as drastic as Donnie sacrificing himself, right, for everybody else. But sort of like Gretchen, knowing that she needs to connect with people that are different than the people her mom connected with, right? And Elizabeth really thinking about ways that she can connect to her brother, right? She has a better relationship with him than he does with his parents. And so being able to find those ways to connect with other people and have that human to human interaction is going to be moving forward the way that people, younger people, the younger generation, that's what Drew Barrymore's character tried to do. Right. When you have the teacher generation gap there. And
she was only 5 years older than Gyllenhaal in this movie.
And so trying to make those human to human connections is what really matters.
Well, it's funny. You bring that, the gap, the generation gap back up because, Kelly wasn't originally supposed to direct this movie. And so he was sort of searching around, and he had an interview or I don't know, whatever, some kind of meeting with Francis Ford Coppola mm-hmm. about directing this movie. Coppola obviously passed, but Kelly said that he was extremely influential because after he read the script, he looked at one of Drew Barrymore's character's lines, which was, "The kids have to figure it all out these days because the parents, they don't have a clue." And Kelly said, he slid the binder down the big table and very dramatically said, "That's what your whole movie's about right there." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Wow, didn't realize that." He was like, I didn't know what my movie was about until that moment. Mm-hmm. So that's what the overarching point of this movie is, that the younger generation wants to break out and be more bold and sort of do things like connect with people in ways that the previous generation either hasn't or hasn't been allowed or has been conditioned not to.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally agree.
I also think that there's kind of an interesting thing at the end with Donnie's mom and Gretchen waving to each other with that vague recognition, but not knowing why.
There's a woman connection there, too.
I think that there's this idea of female intuition, female intuition that is sort of like, yeah, Donnie this whole time has this otherworldly thing, but in our real world and society, a lot of times you will see that kind of mother or women intuition that is prevalent just in real life.
Well, if you compare to the reactions by the men in that final montage, like you have Frank and you have Jim, both of them are self-preservational
mm-hmm.
emotions. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that anything bad about Frank. We don't really know anything. It seems like a fine enough kid. He just was in a bad spot. But his thing is about how he probably had a nightmare about how he got shot in the eye mm-hmm. and he woke up and he was freaking out and he was crying.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Cunningham obviously is
trying to get away from punishment for his crimes.
He may have had a dream about what happened in that universe,
his crimes are crimes reprehensible against the younger generation as well, which is another kind of generation gap.
Well, and he's literally called the Antichrist by the Christ-like figure in the movie.
Right, exactly.
So can we talk about Swayze real quick?
He's such a good actor.
We didn't really talk about him as much as I would have imagined we would talk about him.
Well, his character is tough.
He is tough. It's a tough thing.
You know he frosted his hair for that role?
Did you know that his wardrobe is his actual clothes from the 80s?
He's just the best.
He's like this just obnoxious motivational speaker type, and he fits right into that whole vibe of like these teachers or the school system. Like, it's again the generation gap. Like, they don't understand what is going to help these kids, and it's not Patrick Swayze talking at them
mm-hmm.
and being like, "You just got to feel better, man." Mm-hmm. Like,
well, what I like about his casting always is that he's still, at the beginning of the movie, very likable and charming.
Yeah.
Like, you know that he's a snake oil salesman. You don't know all the other stuff that goes on, but it's still Swayze. You know, he's still this. He's got the megawatt smile and he's
so much charisma.
So much charisma, but in such a singular way.
Yeah. There's nobody like Swayze.
There's nobody like him.
Well, we were talking last night about his three of our like main roles that we've seen him in, which are Point Break, Donnie Darko, and Roadhouse. And
don't get me wrong, I've also seen him in Ghost and Dirty Dancing.
Well, what my point originally when I started the conversation was like, he has this undercurrent of like zen under all of these characters, mm-hmm. but they're all completely different characters.
Yeah, and it's the same with Dirty Dancing and Ghost.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just love him.
Yeah.
This movie is heavily influenced by the way the soundtrack makes you feel when things hit, what songs hit, when they hit. What is your favorite of the main songs? So I listed a couple of the main songs, which are The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen, which plays in the beginning.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division, which plays at the party.
Classic.
Head Over Heels by Tears for Fears, which plays, I think, during the school scene, the first school scene.
Sure.
I wrote Notorious.
Notorious.
By Duran Duran, which plays at the sisters' dance recital thing. Mm-hmm. And Mad World, of course. The Tears for Fears cover by Michael Andrews and Gary Jules that plays over the ending montage. What's your favorite, or what's the best fit in the movie?
Okay, so here's the thing. The right answer is Mad World. But the problem is that it really sparked the Mad World cover being in everything.
It did.
And now being cliche.
Yes.
That's the problem. Like, it's not a problem because this movie came out in 2001 and, like, it's so perfect. But now it's kind of corny.
All of these songs are perfect.
Yeah.
Like, even Notorious, because it's still new wavy, but it's, like, different. It's more upbeat and it's more, like, fits, like, what the parents would want the kids to be dancing mm-hmm. to if they had to dance to something that was a little bit more updated.
Yeah.
The other songs are depressing.
I mean, Love Will Tear Us Apart is one of my high school emo days songs. I loved that song.
It's also supposed to be a joke, a joking response to the Captain and Tennille song.
Yeah. Love Will Keep Us Together. Love Will
Keep Us Together, yeah.
Yeah. It's good stuff right there. Yeah,
it's very like punky kind of kind of deal there.
So I do like that, and I like that playing it's during the party scene, right?
Oh, and the lyrics are perfect for the party scene too.
So that one I also really like. And the first song's great.
The Killing Moon.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. The Echo and the Bunny Man, they were a popular band in the UK, and the singer was like, when I sing that song, we went out and had like the best career, you know, might not be the most famous band in the world, but like when I sing that song, I'm like, nobody's got a song like this. And it's true. It's like a 6.5 minute song, and it's like, it's the perfect tone setter for this movie. I'm going to go with that one as my best one for the same reason. Of course it's Mad World, but for the same reason, like watching this movie in 2024, Killing Moon, I think, hit me more than Mad World did. But maybe in 2001, it would have been different.
Right.
I think that's all I've got. Oh, Ebert, just real quick, gave it 2.5 stars out of 4. He liked it, but he thought it kind of fumbled the bag at the end.
Okay.
He said, the setup and development is fascinating, the payoff less so. I could tell you what I think happens at the end and what the movie's about, but I would not be sure I was right. See, it's not just everybody. It's also Roger Ebert.
Mm-hmm.
The movie builds twists on top of turns until the plot wheel revolves one time too many and we're left scratching our heads. We don't demand answers at the end, but we want some kind of closure. Kaiser mm-hmm. Soze may not explain everything in The Usual Suspects, but it feels like he does.
Mm. I get that. Totally.
We didn't talk about, just real quick, the taglines.
Oh, tell me.
The taglines for this movie, I don't think they knew how to market this movie. The one of the taglines, I ordered them in a way where I don't know, whatever. First one, why are you wearing that stupid man suit?
I kind of like that.
That I feel like that was from like a reissue or something like that.
Gotta be.
What would you do if you knew the future?
Nah, I don't like that one.
Like a lot of them are...
For a mainstream movie.
For a movie that's not this.
Right.
Dark, darker, darko.
No.
Horrible.
No, no,
horrible.
No, no,
horrible.
No.
Horrible. That's two thumbs down for that one. And then finally, this one sounds like a John Candy
freeze frame at the end.
From like 1983.
All right, tell me.
Life is one long, insane trip. Some people just have better directions.
That is not for this movie.
That is one of it's Steve Martin. I'm just thinking of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Could anything be worse than dark, darker, darko? Well, we found it.
Those may be the two worst taglines I've ever heard that are like totally inappropriate for the movie that they're marketing.
That's awful.
Those are so bad. Awful. I wouldn't have even circled back to the taglines if they weren't
so egregious.
Weren't so egregious. All right. Yeah. So does Donnie Darko make Baby's First Watch List?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think that our children could learn from this movie? Or like, why?
Why
would we show them this movie?
Oh, for the vibes.
I guess.
See what they get out of it. I think that would be fun.
Yeah.
See what they pick out.
I find that, I hope that they don't equate us with the parents in this movie.
Hope not.
I mean, Mrs. Farmer rules. Don't get me wrong. Mrs. Farmer was amazing. But the mom is actually really, like, one thing that we didn't really talk about is the mom is, like, she's connected to a degree. Like, especially after she meets the therapist and they talk about him having...
She just wants to do what's best and doesn't know how.
And I think it's
hard.
While we've been talking about this sort of, like Reagan era stifling... I think that you could see that in her, like mm-hmm. in the patriarchal type of way,
yep.
where like she probably wants to approach things a different way, but the dad's the man of the house and that. So she does what she can. She talks to him, mm-hmm. Like in his room at one point in the movie. And that's a great scene.
Yep.
And she probably wants, it seems like she wants to do more than she is actually able to do because of sort of just the way that society is set up.
And also just not knowing what
to
do.
And not knowing how to do it because she probably was never taught how to, or never showed how to do it by her parents. So it's sort of a, you know.
She's a really interesting character.
She is a really interesting character. We didn't really get to talk too much about her, but I think that she's just a shout out. Yeah, so thank you for joining us for Donnie Darko.
And if that was a struggle, listen to our Irish Voice episode.
Yeah, I mean, the back-to-back episodes. Well, no, we did Mission Impossible in between. Yeah. Even that to this one is
it's a leap.
It's a leap. So what are we doing next week? Oh, The Iron Claw.
Yeah, I'm excited.
We're going to do The Iron Claw next week. 2023's The Iron Claw, starring Zac Efron, Jeremy Allen White, Harris Dickinson, and many more, I think. It's about the Von Erich wrestling family. And it got a lot of good reviews towards the end of last year. Didn't do anything in award season, I think, because it was A, released too late, and B, A24 was focused more on the Zone of Interest and Past Lives. Mm-hmm. But heard great things about it. I think it's finally streaming.
I can't wait.
Let me check where it is if you want to check it out. Looks really great.
It's going to be sad.
It is going to be sad. It's a notoriously sad story. It'll be out soon. You can rent it now, but I think it's going to be on Max somewhat soon.
I think they even cut a brother out because it was so sad that they're like, we can't make
well,
it even more sad.
They combine. I think they combined some of his stuff with one of the other brothers.
Yeah.
But yeah, so hopefully you'll watch that and you'll check us out next week. And like I said at the beginning, keep following us on social media because we're going
to be a short episode,
posting
Tom.
A lot of stuff. Donnie Darko.
Donnie
we will
Darko.
See you next week for The Iron Claw.
Bye.
Bye.
Happy Easter.